and forming another wave. The use of the lake formation caused the Neman to spread out in a long, thin line to meet the long line of attacking men. Once the Neman spread out, Temujin switched to his third tactic. He regrouped his squads one behind the other in the chisel formation, which was narrow across the front but extremely deep, allowing the attackers to channel maximum force to one point on the now thinned Neman lines and chisel through them. The tactics seemed to be, at least in part, an amalgamation of older fighting techniques and hunting strategies. Yet, the consistent inability of the perplexed enemy to respond effectively to this form of warfare indicated that Temujin had introduced enough innovation to make these strategies uniquely his own. Temujin had produced a new type of steppe army, based on a greater variety of tactics, and most important, close cooperation among the men and complete obedience to their commanders. They were no longer an attacking swarm of individuals. They were now a united formation. Temujin used a set of maneuvers that each man had to know, and to which each responded precisely and without hesitation. The Mongols had a saying, "If he sends me into fire or water, I go. I go for him." The saying reflected not just an ideal, but the reality of the new Mongol warfare. And it made short order of the Neman. The Mongols were gaining the advantage, but Temujin did not race to victory. The night before what everyone expected would be the decisive battle, he told his men to sleep soundly. On the other side, confused, disoriented, and their line of communication broken, the Neman began to flee during the night. Temujin, however, held his soldiers in check and did not pursue them. The night was dark and moonless, and the only escape route was on the steep backside of the mountain. Unable to see, the fleeing men and their horses slipped and fell into the gorge. In the words of the secret history, their bodies piled up like rotten logs at the bottom of the cliff. The next morning, the Mongol forces easily defeated the few remaining Neman and finished Taiyang Khan. Among the warriors who had successfully escaped, Taiyang Khan's son Guchluk fled to the distant Tian Shan Mountains of the Black Khitan, while Jamaka disappeared into the forest. There was no group left where Jamaka might find refuge, and his end would come with a slow whimper, not with a climactic final struggle. Even the few remaining bands of Merkid were quickly swallowed by the growing Mongol nation, and the 40-year-old Jamaka lived as an outcast bandit with a small number of followers who fed themselves on wild animals. In an odd reversal of fate, the once aristocratic Jamaka had been reduced to the same state of existence that the young Temujin had faced when his father died. In 1205, the year of the ox, a year after the victory over the Neman, Jamaka's followers, desperate and resigned to defeat, seized him and delivered him to Temujin. Despite the animosity between the two men, Temujin valued loyalty above all else. Rather than reward the men who brought Jamaka to him, Temujin had all of them executed in front of the leader whom they had betrayed. The final meeting between the two men, who had fought each other for more than 20 years, formed an emotional high point of the secret history. Rather than seek revenge against Jamaka, now that he was past posing a threat to him, Temujin offered to unite with him again. "Let us be companions. Now we are joined together once again. We should remind each other of things we have forgotten. Wake each other from our sleep. Even when you went away and were apart from me, you were still my lucky, blessed, sworn brother. Surely, in the days of killing and being killed, the pit of your stomach and your heart pained for me. Surely, in the days of slaying and being slain, your breast and your heart pained for me. Jamaka seemed moved by the plea, and by the emotion of his erstwhile junior partner, who now ruled all that Jamaka once had, and much more. He seemed, for a moment, to fall into Temujin's sentimental nostalgia for the brotherhood of their youth. Jamaka responded, "We ate the food that is not to be digested, and we spoke to each other the words that are not to be forgotten, while sharing together the quilt under which we slept." Jamaka then blamed their separation on the influence of another unnamed person. "We have been provoked by one who cuts across us. We have been goaded by one who came from the side." The secret history offers a lengthy confession and repentance by Jamaka. But both the grandiose prose and the detail of its account invite suspicion regarding its accuracy. "Now, when the world is ready for you," the text quotes Jamaka saying, "what use is there in my becoming a companion to you? On the contrary, sworn brother, in the black night I would haunt your dreams. In the bright day I would trouble your heart. I would be the louse in your collar. I would become the splinter in your door panel." Almost like a modern lawyer pleading for mercy based on psychological problems and emotional disability, Jamaka reflected back on their youth, searching for an explanation of why he had been so drawn to Temujin and why he had betrayed him. Jamaka explained laconically that he himself had lost both of his parents, had no siblings or trusted companions, and had a shrew for a wife. But rather than asking for mercy in the end, Jamaka asked for death, with a single request: that they kill him in the aristocratic way, without shedding his blood on the earth, or exposing it to the sun and sky. Although he had failed Temujin in life, Jamaka offered to be a better friend to him in death. He vowed that if Temujin would place his body in a high place, he would watch over Temujin and all of his descendants. "Kill me and lay down my dead bones in the high ground. Then, eternally and forever, I will protect the seed of your seed and become a blessing for them." Legend says that Temujin buried Jamaka in the golden belt that he had given to Jamaka when they swore the oath of Andas. Jamaka had been Temujin's first rival, and now he ended his life as the last of the Mongol aristocrats opposing him. In Temujin's long quest for control of the Mongol clans, Temujin had defeated every tribe on the steppe, and removed the threat of every aristocratic lineage by killing off their men and marrying their women to his sons and other followers. He chafed under the authority of anyone who stood above him. He killed Begtyr to rule over his family. He destroyed the Merkid because they took his wife. He killed off the Tatars who had killed his father and looked down on the Mongols as little more than steppe rats. He overthrew the nobles of his own Mongol people and eliminated one by one the higher-ranking Mongol clans of the Taichud and the Jurkin. When his own ally and father figure refused to allow a marriage between their respective families, Temujin destroyed him and his tribe. When the Naiman queen mocked the Mongols as her inferiors, he attacked the tribe, killed her husband, and gave her to one of his men as a wife. Finally, he killed Jamaka, one of the people whom he most loved in life, and thereby destroyed the aristocratic Jadaran clan. Temujin now ranked as undisputed ruler of a vast land, controlling everything from the Gobi in the south to the Arctic tundra in the north, from the Manchurian forests in the east to the Altai mountains of the west. His empire was grass, and contained far more animals than humans. Victory on the battlefield alone did not confer legitimacy of rule until it was publicly acclaimed at a hurultai of representatives from every part of the territory. If a group chose not to send anyone, then they rejected the rule of the Khan, who called it. The Khan could not claim to rule them, and more important, they could not claim his protection. Temujin allowed another year to restore peace and mend relations before he called the Hurultai to install him in office. In 1206, the year of the tiger, Temujin returned to the headwaters of the Onon River near his sacred mountain of Burhan Haldun and summoned a Hurultai, probably the largest and most important ever held in steppe history. Tens of thousands of animals grazed nearby to provide milk and meat for the festivities. The lines of Gurus stretched for miles in every direction from the camp of Temujin, and at the center of all stood the horse-haired Suld, the spirit banner that had guided Temujin to this event. Days of great solemnity and massive ceremony alternated with days of celebration, sports, and music. The court shamans, including Teb Tengger, pounded their drums and sang by day, and musicians performed at dusk. The night air filled with the mesmerizing drone of the distinctive type of Mongolian throat singing, or overtone singing, in which men make sounds from so deep inside their bodies that they can follow two musical lines simultaneously. As with every major political event, young people competed in wrestling, horse racing, and archery, the traditional games of the Mongol known as Nadam. Temujin controlled a vast territory, roughly the size of modern Western Europe, but with a population of about 1 million people of the different nomadic tribes under his control, and probably some 15 to 20 million animals. He ruled not merely as the Khan of the Tatars, the Kariat, or the Naiman. He was to be the ruler of all the people of the Felt Walls. And for this new empire, he chose a new official name derived from his own tribe. He named his people Yek Mongol Ulus, the Great Mongol Nation. After uniting all the people, he abolished inherited aristocratic titles in their lineages, clans, and tribes. All such offices belonged to the state, not to the individual or his family, and they would be distributed at the will of the new ruler. For himself, Temujin rejected the older tribal titles, such as Gur Khan or Tayang Khan, and chose instead the title that his own followers probably already used for him, Chinggis Khan, a name that later became known in the West through the Persian spelling as Genghis Khan. The Mongolian word Chin means strong, firm, unshakable, and fearless, and it is close to the Mongolian word for wolf, Chino, the ancestor from whom they claimed descent. It was a simple but fitting title for the new Khan. Like most successful rulers, Genghis Khan understood the political potential of solemn ceremony and grand spectacle. Unlike most rulers confined within the architecture of buildings, such as palaces or temples, however, the installation of Genghis Khan took place on the vast open steppe, where hundreds of thousands of people participated. Mongol public ceremonies created a marked impression on visitors and chroniclers who described them in detail. The fullest surviving account available comes from the 17th century French biographer François Petit de Lacroix, who had access to now-lost Persian and Turkish documents of the era. According to Petit, Genghis Khan's followers placed him upon a black felt carpet, which they had spread on the ground. and the person who was ordered to give the people's voice pronounced to him aloud the people's pleasure. The speaker admonished Genghis Khan that whatever authority of power he had given him was derived from heaven, and that God would not fail to bless and prosper his designs if he governed his subjects well and justly, but that, on the contrary, he would render himself miserable if he abused that power. The ceremony provided an unmistakable sign of support from his followers, who publicly demonstrated their submission by raising him up on a carpet above their heads and literally carrying him to the throne. Then they bowed their knees 9 times before this new emperor to shew the obedience they promised to him. Just as the presence of each lineage committed its support to Genghis Khan, the presence of each shaman showed that his spirits and dreams had instructed him to do likewise. Without an organized religion, the shamans conferred a spiritual blessing on the event and made it more than just a political occasion. Through their presence, the event became a sacred proclamation of Temujin's spiritually ordained destiny from the eternal blue sky. Shamans beat the drums, chanted to the spirits of nature, and sprinkled Ayrak into the air and on the ground. The assembled throngs of people prayed, standing in uniform ranks with the palms of their hands facing upward toward the eternal blue sky. They concluded their prayers and sent them skyward with the ancient Mongol phrase, "Hooray, hooray, hooray," that ended all prayers, similar to the Christian use of Amen. This spiritual act made each of them a part of the election and sealed a religious covenant not just between themselves and their leader, but also with the spiritual world. Most leaders, whether kings or presidents, grew up inside the institutions of some type of state. Their accomplishments usually involved the reorganization or revitalization of those institutions and the state that housed them. Genghis Khan, however, consciously set out to create a state and to establish all the institutions necessary for it on a new basis, part of which he borrowed from prior tribes, and part of which he invented. For his nation-state to survive, he needed to build strong institutions. And for Genghis Khan, this began with the army that brought him to power. He made it even stronger and more central to the government. Under Genghis Khan, cowherds, shepherds, and camel boys advanced to become generals and rode at the front of armies of 1,000 or 10,000 warriors. Every healthy male aged 15 to 70 was an active member of the army. Just as he had done when first elected tribal Khan, he appointed his most loyal followers as the heads of groups of 1,000 soldiers and their households, and his oldest followers, such as Borch, took charge of units of 10,000. He rewarded men who came from lowly backboned lineages and placed them in the highest positions based on their achievements and proven loyalty to him on and off the battlefield. Compared with the units of 10,000 that he gave to his loyal friends, those assigned to the controls of members of his own family were more meager. 5,000 each to his mother, his youngest brother, and his 2 youngest sons, Ogode and Tolu. With only 8,000 for Chagatai and 9,000 for Joch, even his 2 eldest sons did not receive a full tumen of 10,000. Genghis Khan appointed trusted friends of his own to oversee the administration for several family members, particularly for his mother, youngest brother, and Chagatai. He explained the need for such overseers by stating that Chagatai was obstinate and has a petty, narrow mind. He warned the advisers to stay behind him morning and evening to advise him. In order to maintain peace in this large and ethnically diverse set of tribes that he had forged into one nation, He quickly proclaimed new laws to suppress the traditional causes of tribal feuding and war. The great law of Genghis Khan differed from that of other lawgivers in history. He did not base his law on divine revelation from God, nor did he derive it from an ancient code of any sedentary civilization. He consolidated it from the customs and traditions of the herding tribes, as maintained over centuries. Yet he readily abolished old practices when they hindered the functioning of his new society. He allowed groups to follow traditional law in their area, so long as it did not conflict with the great law, which functioned as a supreme law or a common law over everyone. The great law, however, did not represent a single codification of the law so much as an ongoing body of legal work that he continued to develop throughout the remaining two decades of his life. Genghis Khan's law did not delve into all aspects of daily life. Instead, he used it to regulate the most troublesome aspects. As long as men kidnapped women, there would be feuding on the steppes. Genghis Khan's first new law reportedly forbade the kidnapping of women. Almost certainly a reaction to the kidnapping of his wife Bort. The persistent potential for strife originating in such kidnapping still plagued Genghis Khan within his own family in the uncertainty of whether his eldest son had been fathered by him or by Bort's kidnapper. And the uncertainty would cause increasingly more severe problems as Genghis Khan grew older. Concomitant with an end to kidnapping, he forbade the abduction and enslavement of any Mongol. From his own capture and enslavement by the Taichud, he knew the individual and personal anguish of being abducted and forced to work as a slave. But he also recognized how detrimental the practice was to the entire social fabric, and what strong animosities and violence it perpetrated throughout the tribes of the steppe. Genghis Khan sought to remove every source of internal dissension within the ranks of his followers. Based upon his own experiences over the disruptions that surrounded questions of the legitimacy of children, he declared all children legitimate, whether born to a wife or a concubine. Because haggling over the value of a wife as though she were a camel could provoke lingering dissension among his men, he forbade the selling of women into marriage. For the same reasons, he outlawed adultery, an act that the Mongols defined differently than most people. It did not include sexual relations between a woman and her husband's close relatives, nor those between a man and female servants, or the wives of other men in his household. In keeping with Genghis Khan's dictum that matters of the Gur should be decided within the Gur, and matters of the steppe decided on the steppe, adultery applied to relations between married people of separate households. As long as it did not cause a public strife between families, it did not rank as a crime. Theft of animals had always been considered wrong, but it had been commonplace in the raiding culture of the steppes, and had also been the cause of lingering animosity and discord. Perhaps remembering the great harm caused to his family when their 8 geldings were stolen, Genghis Khan made animal rustling a capital offense. Additionally, he required anyone finding a lost animal to return it to the rightful owner. For this purpose, he instituted a massive lost and found system that continued to grow as his empire spread. Any person who found such goods, money, or animals, and did not turn them in to the appropriate supervisor, would be treated as a thief. The penalty for theft was execution. Aside from fighting over lost animals, the steppe people argued frequently over hunting rights for wild animals. Genghis Khan codified existing ideals by forbidding the hunting of animals between March and October during the breeding time. By protecting the animals in the summer, Genghis Khan also provided a safety net for the winter, and hunters had to limit their kill to what they needed for food and no more. the law also specified how animals should be hunted, as well as the manner of butchering, so as to waste nothing. In addition to sex, property, and food, Genghis Khan recognized the disruptive potential of competing religions. In one form or another, virtually every religion, from Buddhism to Christianity, and Manichaeism to Islam, had found converts among the steppe people. And almost all of them claimed not only to be the true religion, but the only one. In probably the first law of its kind anywhere in the world, Genghis Khan decreed complete and total religious freedom for everyone. Although he continued to worship the spirits of his homeland, he did not permit them to be used as a national cult. To promote all religions, Genghis Khan exempted religious leaders and their property from taxation and from all types of public service. To promote related professions, he later extended the same tax exemptions to a range of professionals who provided essential public services, including undertakers, doctors, lawyers, teachers, and scholars. Genghis Khan made a number of laws designed specifically to prevent fighting over the office of Khan. According to his law, the Khan must always be elected by a Hurultai. He made it a capital offense for any member of his family to claim the office without election. To prevent rival candidates from killing each other, he ordered that the death penalty would be applied to members of his family only through a Hurultai of the whole family and not through any individual member. In so doing, he outlawed the very means that he himself had used to begin his rise to power, killing his half-brother. Mongol law, as codified by Genghis Khan, recognized group responsibility and group guilt. The solitary individual had no legal existence outside the context of the family and the larger units to which it belonged. Therefore, the family carried the responsibility of ensuring the correct behavior of its members. A crime by one could bring punishment to all. Similarly, a tribe or a squad of soldiers bore the same liability for one another's actions, and thereby the entire nation. Not just the army or just the civil administration bore responsibility for upholding and enforcing the law. To be a just Mongol, one had to live in a just community. Enforcement of the law and the responsibility to abide by it began at the highest level, with the Khan himself. In this manner, Genghis Khan had proclaimed the supremacy of the rule of law over any individual, even the sovereign. By subjugating the ruler to the law, he achieved something that no other civilization had yet accomplished. Unlike many civilizations, and most particularly Western Europe, where monarchs ruled by the will of God and reigned above the law, Genghis Khan made it clear that his great law applied as strictly to the rulers as to everyone else. His descendants proved able to abide by this rule for only about 50 years after his death, before they discarded it. To run the empire in general, but most specifically to record the many new laws and to administer them over the vast stretches of land now under his control, Genghis Khan ordered the adoption of a writing system. Although writing had been introduced to the steppes many centuries earlier by Muslim merchants and itinerant Christian monks, few of the native people learned the skill. Even those among the most sophisticated tribes of Tatars, Naiman, and Cariad. And so far as is known, no Mongol had learned it. In his conquest of the Naiman in 1204, Genghis Khan discovered that Tayang Khan kept a scribe who wrote down his pronouncements and then embossed them with an official state seal. The scribe came from the Uyghur people, who had originated on the Mongol steppe, but in the 9th century had migrated to the oases of what is now the Xinjiang region of western China. The Uyghur language was closely related and proved relatively easy to adapt for writing in the Mongolian language. Derived from the Syriac alphabet used by the missionary monks who brought Christianity to the steppe tribes, the writing was made from letters rather than characters, but it flowed vertically down the page in columns, like Chinese. To keep track of his laws, Genghis Khan created the position of supreme judge for his adopted brother, Shighutuk, the Tatar boy with the golden earrings and nose ring whom he had found and given to his mother to raise. Genghis Khan charged him to punish the thieves and put right the lies, as well as to keep a record of his decisions on white paper bound in blue books, the sacred color of the eternal sky. This close association between writing and the keeping of the law in Genghis Khan's administration probably accounts for why the Mongolian word for book, nom, was derived from the Greek nomos, meaning law. In the Mongol world of the 13th century, the law and the written word were one and the same. In maintaining loyalty and cohesion in the vast apparatus of a state, Genghis Khan innovated on an ancient political practice of hostage-taking. He demanded that each of the commanders of the units of 1,000 and 10,000 send their own sons and their sons' best friends to him personally to make his own unit of 10,000. Instead of threatening to kill them if their relatives misbehaved, Genghis Khan introduced a far more effective strategy. Genghis Khan trained the would-be hostages as administrators and kept them as a ready reserve to replace any ineffective or disloyal official. The threat of such potential replacement probably did much more to ensure loyalty in the field than the threat that the relative might be killed. Genghis Khan thus changed the status of hostages, transforming them into an integral part of his government that gave almost every family a direct and personal connection to the imperial court. Genghis Khan divided the elite unit into the day guard and the night guard. As the name indicated, they formed a permanent watch over him and his encampment, but they functioned as much more than a bodyguard. They controlled the boys and girls who worked in the court, and they organized the herders of the different animals. They oversaw the movement of the camp, together with all the weapons and accoutrements of the state. Banners, pikes, and drums. They also controlled the cooking vessels and the slaughter of animals. And they ensured the proper distribution of meat and dairy products. The guard helped to adjudicate legal hearings, carry out punishments, and generally enforce the law. Because they controlled the entrance to and egress from the royal tents, they formed the basis of governmental administration. All members of Genghis Khan's own regiment held the rank of elder brother to the other 9 units of 10,000, and therefore they could issue orders to any of them and expect to be obeyed without question. Unlike other armies in which each individual held a rank, in the Mongol army, the entire unit held a rank. The lowest-ranking man in Genghis Khan's 2 men of 10,000 outranked the highest-ranking men of the other 2 men. In turn, within each 2 men, every member of the commander's unit of 1,000 outranked every man in the other 9 units of 1,000. To facilitate communication so that the orders got to the intended recipient, Genghis Khan relied on a system of fast riders known as arrow messengers. The military supplied the riders, but the local people supplied the stations. The postal service ranked alongside the military in importance for the Mongols, and individual Mongols were allowed to serve in it in lieu of regular military service. Depending on local terrain, the stations were set approximately 20 miles apart, and each station required about 25 families to maintain and operate it. Although the stations were open for public use, much of the information on the individual stations and the total number at any given time remained a carefully guarded secret, and therefore the information has not survived. Some idea of its expanse can be derived from the 18th century, however, when the system still operated and required approximately 64 stations to cross Mongolia from the Altai Mountains in the west to the entrance through the Great Wall into China in the east. Genghis Khan adapted a variety of older methods of communication over shorter distances, such as the use of torches, whistling arrows, smoke, flares, and flags, for even more rapid transmission of information during maneuvers, hunts, and military movements. The herders had earlier developed a complicated system of arm signals that could be used long after individuals had passed out of hearing range. And under Genghis Khan, these too were built upon to make an ever more elaborate system of rapid and efficient communication for use in battle or troop maneuvers. Peace and prosperity bred their own problems for Genghis Khan. 6 years of peace allowed, or possibly encouraged, the intrigues and the petty rivalries that threatened to undo Genghis Khan's hard-fought unification of the tribes. The more powerful he became, the more disagreements sparked among his followers, particularly within his own family, whose members felt entitled to substantially larger shares of goods and power than his allies outside the family. Genghis Khan's court of trusted advisors included almost none of his own relatives. He sent his mother to live with her youngest son, Temüg, who by step tradition was called Öcsügen, the prince of the hearth, and had the responsibility of caring for his parents in their old age. With a steadfastly loyal army, and without family or old aristocrats as rivals, new trouble arose from an unexpected source. Tebtenger, Genghis Khan's shaman. He had proclaimed time and again that the eternal blue sky favored Genghis Khan and would make him ruler of the world. He interpreted dreams and all kinds of signs in favor of Genghis Khan's success and as indications of his great importance. Genghis Khan exploited not only the supernatural value that Tebtenger contributed to his court, but his practical value as well, as when he appointed him to oversee the estates of Oylun and Temüg Öcsügen. Tebtenger used his position to enrich himself and his six brothers, who formed a powerful coalition and, because of his supernatural power, had a following within the newly created Mongol nation, second only to that of Genghis Khan himself. On one occasion, the seven brothers ganged up on Genghis Khan's brother Kassar and beat him. Afterward, Kassar went to Genghis Khan's gur, fell to his knees, and begged his brother to help him. Never completely trustful of his own family, Genghis Khan rebuked his brother and mockingly asked how it was that he, who had once been renowned as the strongest man in the tribe, could now be beaten by these men. According to the secret history, Kassar broke into tears of shame as he knelt before his brother. He left the gur, and in his anger, fear, and humiliation, he did not speak to Genghis Khan for 3 days. Apparently emboldened by the small success against Kassar, Tebtenger reported to Genghis Khan shortly thereafter that a dream had come to him in which he saw that Genghis Khan would rule the nation, but that in another dream, he saw that Kassar would rule it. He urged Genghis Khan to strike quickly and firmly against his brother to prevent any threat to his own rule. Genghis Khan immediately ordered Kassar arrested and stripped of his small contingent of followers. Genghis Khan's mother lived a day's journey away from his court with her youngest son, but she quickly heard of the trouble. She already resented Tebtenger's power over her as one of the administrators of her estate, and she became enraged at hearing of the strife he had caused between her sons. Despite the late hour, Oylun hitched her white camel to her black cart and rode through the night to reach her son's royal encampment at sunrise. According to the secret history, Genghis Khan froze in surprise as his mother charged unexpectedly into his gur, untied Kassar, put his hat back on his head, and helped him to tie the sash around his waist. working herself into ever greater anger against her eldest son. She sat down cross-legged, ripped open her deal, and pulled out her breasts that were now so old, wrinkled, and worn from nourishing five children, that according to the secret history, even as she held them up in her hands, they still rested on her knees. "Have you seen these?" she demanded angrily of Genghis Khan, as she held up her withered breasts with both hands. "These are the breasts that you sucked." She then launched into a long tirade against her son. In much the same words that she had used when he killed his half-brother Begtar, she accused him of acting like an animal that gnaws its own umbilical cord and chews its own afterbirth. To calm and appease her, Genghis Khan agreed to restore Khazar's freedom and his control over some of his followers. Soon after the fight with her son, Oilun, who was probably in her late 50s, died. Her property should have passed, according to tradition, to her youngest son, who wanted to add it to his own, giving him control over a total of 10,000 people, more than any other family member. The shaman Teb Tengger and his six brothers, perhaps with Genghis Khan's implied consent, pushed Temug Ochigen aside and seized the estate of Oilun and her followers. When Temug tried to get back his followers, Teb Tengger and his brothers publicly humiliated Genghis Khan's youngest brother by making him kneel on the ground behind Teb Tengger's backside and beg for his life. Despite the repeated outcries from relatives, Genghis Khan continued to ally himself with Teb Tengger rather than his own family. The only family member to whom Genghis Khan still seemed willing to listen was his wife Burt. She understood more clearly than her husband the danger posed by seven powerful brothers who stood firmly united and now had their own following within the Mongol nation. After hearing of the latest episode, the humiliation of his youngest brother, Bort angrily explained to Genghis Khan that by allowing Teb Tengger so much power, Genghis Khan's own sons were in danger. Just as she had been the one to advise Temujin to break with Jamukha back when they had combined their followers, she now demanded that he break with Teb Tengger and his family. If Teb Tengger could do these things to the great Khan's brothers while the Khan still lived, she asked her husband, what would he do to the sons or widows after the Khan died? The next time Teb Tengger appeared in court with his six brothers and their father Monglik, Temug Ochigen was waiting inside the Gur with Genghis Khan. As soon as Teb Tengger was seated, Temug came up to him and grabbed him by the collar of his deal. Genghis Khan, pretending that the two men were merely about to wrestle, ordered them to take the contest outside the Gur. Temug, however, was not seeking a wrestling contest with Teb Tengger. He was seeking punishment against him. As soon as Temug pulled Teb Tengger through the doorway of the Gur, three men waited to grab and snap his back. Genghis Khan ordered that a small tent be erected over the dying man, and everyone deserted the area. Teb Tengger was the last rival Genghis Khan had to face from the steppe tribes. What he could not control, he had destroyed. He had neutralized the power of his own relatives, killed the lineages of aristocrats and all rival Khans, abolished the old tribes, redistributed the people, and finally allowed the most powerful shaman on the steppe to be killed. Genghis Khan appointed a new shaman to take Teb Tengger's place, but he was an older, less ambitious, and more tractable character. Genghis Khan's followers also learned a lesson. They interpreted his victory as a sign that not only did Genghis Khan have military power, but that his spiritual power was greater than that of the most powerful shaman. In the eyes of many followers, Genghis Khan had shown himself to be a powerful shaman. a belief that many Mongols have retained until today. With all the nomadic tribes united, and Genghis Khan securely ensconced as their ruler, it seemed uncertain what should happen next. He had spent so many years locked into the drama with Jamukha and Ong Khan that without them, his large tribe seemed to lack an objective or purpose. Without enemies, they lacked a reason to hold together. Genghis Khan seemed to be searching for new ones, but he found no tribe worthy of a distinction. With no other potential targets, in 1207 he sent his eldest son, 28-year-old Joch, and his two men on a campaign into the area the Mongols called Sibir, from which derives the modern name of Siberia, to secure the submission of the forest tribes and the reindeer herders. Joch returned successfully with thousands of new recruits for the Mongol army, as well as tribal leaders with whom Genghis Khan negotiated a number of alliance marriages, including one with Joch's daughter. In addition to the people, Joch brought back valuable tribute, including rare furs such as black sable, hunting birds, and other forest products. Expansion into the north offered little attraction beyond furs and feathers. It was the south that captured Genghis Khan's greatest attention with its far greater variety of manufactured goods, metal, textiles, and novelties. He received the first infusion of goods from the Uyghur people, who farmed the oases of the great deserts of the Taklimakan and surrounding areas in what is now Xinjiang Autonomous Region in China. Genghis Khan accepted their submission and, in the only way of making an alliance, sought to bring them into his family. He offered his daughter to the Uyghur Khan in marriage, thereby making him his son-in-law. In the extension of kinship to the Siberian tribes and the Uyghur, Genghis Khan was not merely making alliances between his family and their ruling families. He was accepting the entire tribe or nation into his empire as familial members, since in the political idiom of the tribes, granting kinship to the Khan was tantamount to recognizing family ties with the whole nation. In this way, the idiom of kinship had expanded into a type of citizenship. As Genghis Khan continued to utilize and expand that idiom in the coming years, it came to be a form of universal citizenship based not on a common religion, as among Christian and Muslim people, or just on biology, as in traditional tribal culture. It was based simply on allegiance, acceptance, and loyalty. In time, all the non-Mongol kingdoms in the Mongol Empire became known as Har, derived from the word for black, and connoting in-laws. Thus, select nations such as the Uyghur and the Koreans, as well as select Turkic groups, would have the honor of being in-laws to the Mongols, whereas intermarriage outside of the black kin would not be permitted. When the Uyghur Khan came to the Mongol court for his wedding in approximately 1209, he arrived laden with a camel caravan of lavish gifts, including gold, silver, and pearls of many sizes, shapes, and colors. Without the craft of weaving, the Mongols had only leather, fur, and felt made from pressed wool. So the most important gifts to them were the incredible woven textiles, including silk, brocade, damask, and satin. The visit of the Uyghurs highlighted the contrast between the wealth of the agricultural civilization and the poverty of the steppe tribes. Genghis Khan commanded a great army, but presided over a largely impoverished people. While to the south, beyond the Gobi, there flowed an intermittent but impressive stream of goods along the Silk Route. He was ready for the opportunity to redress this imbalance of goods and to test his army against others. But such an endeavor carried great risks. Genghis Khan was eager to take the chance, and soon the opportunity, as though delivered in answer to his prayers, presented itself. No one had yet taken any notice of this upstart ruler in his newly proclaimed nation of Mongols. Outside of the high inner steppe of Asia, at the time, few people paid attention to the killing of one barbarian chief and the crowning of a newcomer. Nor did they relate the destruction of one savage tribe and the rise of its rival. The battles of petty tribes fighting over horses, women, and bolts of cloth lacked the apparent importance of the much more momentous struggles of real civilizations. All of that was about to change. Part 2. The Mongol World War, 1211 to 1261. By the arms of Zingis and his descendants, the globe was shaken. The sultans were overthrown. The caliphs fell, and the Caesars trembled on their throne. Edward Gibbon, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Chapter 4. Spitting on the Golden Khan. The hooves of our Mongol horses go everywhere. They climb to the heaven and plunge into the sea. Yeluchukye, 1237. In 1210, the year of the horse, and the 48th year of the life of Genghis Khan, and the 4th year of his new nation, a delegation arrived at the Mongol encampment to proclaim the ascension of a new Golden Khan to the Jurchid throne, and demand the submission of Genghis Khan and the Mongols as a vassal nation. From their capital city of Zhengdu, where modern Beijing now rises, the Jurchid dynasty, founded nearly a century earlier in 1125, ruled Manchuria and much of modern-day Inner Mongolia and northern China. As a tribal people themselves from the forests of Manchuria, they claimed sovereignty over all the tribes of the steppe. Ong Khan had offered allegiance to them in the past, and the Jurchid seemed eager to reassert their superiority over Genghis Khan, who had replaced Ong Khan as the dominant figure among the nomads of the steppe. Jurchid power over the steppe rested not from military prowess, as much as from their tight control of goods flowing to the pastoralists from the workshops and cities across China. The position of a steppe khan rested on his ability to win in battle and to ensure a steady supply of trade goods. Usually the two coincided when battlefield victory provided an opportunity to loot the defeated. Genghis Khan's unprecedented success in defeating and uniting all the tribes had the inadvertent consequence of ending the looting and thereby stifling the flow of goods. Since all manufactured goods originated in the south, Genghis Khan could either offer allegiance to one of the southern rulers and receive goods as a vassal warrior, or he could attack them and seize the goods. Genghis Khan placed no trust in the Jurchid. The Mongols had much closer ethnic and linguistic affinity with the Khitan, whom the Jurchid had defeated and now dominated. Sensing the power of the new Mongol ruler, many Khitan had fled from Jurchid territory to find sanctuary under Genghis Khan. In 1208, four high court officials deserted to the Mongols and urged them to attack the Jurchid. But, fearful of a trap or some other nefarious scheme, Genghis Khan refused. The unexpected death of the Golden Khan of the Jurchid and the ascension of his young son to the throne in 1210 offered the Jurchid court an opportunity to assess Genghis Khan by sending the envoy to him to announce the change of events and demand a strong show of submission from him. An idea of the type of ceremony expected is contained in an 1878 report in the Peking Gazette, describing the investiture of a Mongol official by an envoy from the court of the Manchus, descendants of the Jurchid. The young Mongol knelt reverently upon the ground, and, with the deepest gratitude, acknowledged himself to be a Mongol slave of inferior ability, perfectly unable to repay in the slightest degree the imperial favors of which his family have been the recipients for generations past. He declares his intention of performing his duties to the best of his feeble powers. He then turned himself toward the palace and beat his head upon the ground, in grateful acknowledgment of the imperial bounty. Genghis Khan knew full well how to kowtow. He had done it on Mount Burhan Haldun, in repeated homage to the eternal blue sky. But now, at nearly 50 years of age, he would kowtow to no man. Nor was he anyone's Mongol slave. Upon receiving the order to demonstrate submission, Genghis Khan is reported to have turned to the south and spat on the ground. Then he unleashed a line of vindictive insults to the Golden Khan, mounted his horse, and rode toward the north, leaving the stunned envoy choking in his dust. Genghis Khan's defiance of the envoys of the Golden Khan was tantamount to a declaration of war between the Mongols and the Jurchid. Genghis Khan's need for trade goods already gave him a reason to make war on the Jurchid. And the demand from the Golden Khan for submission now presented him with the pretext for attacking. After the encounter with the Jurchid envoy, Genghis Khan returned to his home base on the Herlin River, and in the spring of 1211, the year of the sheep, summoned a Hurultai. Since everyone knew the issue to be decided, the people could exercise a veto simply by not showing up. If too few people came to the Hurultai, Genghis Khan would not have been able to proceed. By organizing a long public discussion, everyone in the community was included into the process, and most important, everyone understood why they were fighting the war. Although on the battlefield the soldiers were expected to obey without question, even the lowest ranking were treated as junior partners, who were expected to understand the endeavor and to have some voice in it. The senior members met together in large public meetings to discuss the issues, then individually went to their own units to continue the discussion with the lower-ranking warriors. To have the full commitment of every warrior, it was important that each of them, from the highest to the lowest, participate and know where he stood in the larger plan of events. By including representatives from the allied Uyghur and Tangut nations, Genghis Khan solidified his relations with them and thereby protected the exposed underbelly and rear of his land when he launched his invasion. On the home front, he also needed to inspire his people with the courage and understanding of this war. Toward both goals, Genghis Khan appealed to the honor of his followers and to their need to avenge past wrongs. But he also held out to them a much broader opportunity of unlimited goods from the great wealth of the cities of the Jurchid. According to the secret history, once he felt confident that his people and allies stood firmly with him, Genghis Khan publicly withdrew from the assembled delegates of the Hurultai to pray privately on a nearby mountain. He removed his hat and belt, bowed down before the eternal blue sky, and stated his case to his supernatural guardians. He recounted the generations of grievances his people held against the Jurchid, and detailed the torture and killing of his ancestors. He explained that he had not sought this war against the Golden Khan, and had not initiated the quarrel. In his absence, the Mongol people divided into three separate groups, one each of men, women, and children, in order to fast and pray. For three nervous days and nights, the assembled Mongol nation awaited, bareheaded and hungry, the decision of the eternal blue sky and the orders of Genghis Khan. Night and day they mumbled their ancient Mongol prayer of hooray, hooray, hooray to the eternal blue sky. At dawn on the fourth day, Genghis Khan emerged with the verdict. The eternal blue sky has promised us victory and vengeance. As the Mongol army set out south toward the splendid cities of the south, their overly confident Jurchid enemies awaited them and mocked the Mongol advance. Our empire is like the sea. Yours is but a handful of sand.